Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about the structure of the eye. In this episode, I'll talk basically through bits and pieces of the eye, how it's structured, a general data dump about it. So if you sit back and listen, or whatever you're doing, and just listen to it, I'll be able to sort of transfer the information that I've learnt over a long period of time, going into different talks and lectures. It's something that a lot of physicists sort of love to talk about. And as I'm saying, I've got different ideas just tumbling through my head. Okay, so what is the function of the eye? So the eye really came, there's multicellular organisms 500 million years ago, and the land animals roughly 300 million years ago. And so the advent of the eye came out, or light sensitivity came out, in evolution. And I think people believe, just looking at the evolutionary tree, where it was no eyes and different branches, eyes evolved several and multiple times, removing and coming up multiple times. But this is something I always get interesting, is that there was the Octavian, and that's probably incorrect pronunciation, evolutionary explosion. So evolution stayed still for a little while, but there was a series of things which led to an absolute explosion, and one was the invention of sex. So sex didn't occur for a couple of million years, or a fair million years. So there was a sort of a snowball earth, and the effect of a snowball earth, where the life was so successful, began to live so well, it sucked all the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And with no carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the earth froze to a ice ball. And this process, this stress of your entire world freezing, meant that these specialist cells, these... what are they called? Information's going out of my head. Eukaryotic cells, that is, cells with a nucleus, which are, if you can think of, as slave master cells. These are the ancient cells which were going to die out, but then what they did is they rounded up a few bacteria cells and forced them to live inside them forever more, for 500 million years later. You and I are made up of these huge social conglomerations of these slave master cells, or eukaryotic cells. And so these cells existed for a long time, separately as individual cells. It was a while before they got together and said, okay, I'm going to live, but my mate over there, that you can be the sex cell, and you can be create the germline going forward. So this is the entire thing of social cells. That's how it happens. Now, you've got other things floating around on Earth today, which are a colony of different organisms living together. There's these jellyfish, where there is actually different individuals living together, doing different functions. So that's sort of halfway on the way. Now, what happened is that you had the sort of almost simultaneous invention of sex, and soon after that, the evolution of sight. And of course, if you can see air around yourself, you can do several things. You can actually move very far, eat your prey. It means that you've got a new evolutionary pressure on you. You have to actually get camouflaged, and so this invention of sex and sight sort of came together at the same time in the Octavian. I'm sure it's not Octavian. I've only ever read it, and the problem is I've got the word sort of half in my internal vision as a word, and I've never bothered to pronounce it, and I've spoken to anyone about it. But this revolution, there was, you know, enormous exploration of different body forms, different body parts, in it. Now, this is all within the seas, life within the seas. And today we still have a few just rare creatures from this revolution. And this is, you couldn't go past the velvet worm up here in Sydney. So this is it looks a bit like a Japanese Pokemon, but with, you know, the cat bus, but it's got thousands of thousands. This is the cat bus is not a Pokemon. That's the from Ghibli Studios. I'm doing well here. And I've forgotten the name of it. The cat bus. People will probably know it. It looks a bit like a Japanese animation. And it's got all these little stumpy little legs. You know, hundreds of stumpy little legs. It looks really amazing. This is the velvet worm, and it kills by actually pushing out a goop of jelly, sticky jelly, on its victims, and it's a Newtonian viscous thing. That so the more it struggles, the more it stiffens up, and the worm goes in it. I must admit, they're not up in the Blue Mountains, but they're in different parts of Sydney for sure. And we only know that. I've never actually met anyone who's seen one or has one, but just were told that they're around in Sydney. They're fantastic little things to watch, brightly coloured, things like that. And you've also got the hagfish, which I did an episode, and that produces lots of goop. So the Octavian Revolution was explosion. Part of the experimentation was body parts, but it's also ways of killing, getting food, and escaping for food, producing heaps and heaps of goop. And there's still a few animals bumping around, not too many from this era. They're not insects, they're not proper fish, and they're, you know, it's a little bit hard to nail what they are at the moment. But getting back to that stage, really the first vision really goes to something which is neither an animal or a plant, and today we've got examples of it, and it's Euglena. Euglena is an autotroph. It's a bit of a plant, but with a little spermy thing on it, a little flagella on it, and a little light-sensing cell on it. And the light-sensing cell sends out pulses, and when it's at maximum brightness, it propels. And so what you'll do is that if you've got some Euglena and you want to harvest it for your microscope, you just stick a little bit of light in it and scoop it up, and it doesn't take long. Truly, it takes about a minute, and then you scoop the water up, and then your little thing is absolutely full of these little swimming things, and they what they do, they might be aside, but if you turn the light from underneath, they swim towards the light. It's quite, for me, a bit entertaining to see the Euglena under a microscope. So these are plants with little swimming bits, and you say, oh, no, plants don't swim. Oh, well, yes, they do. There's an example of ferns. So how do ferns, they don't, how do they actually mate? So you've got to remember that plants have sex as well, you know. Your little petunia, whatever it is, that's flaunting itself. Basically, the flowers are flaunting each other, and the and various things. So your ferns. This grossed me out when I first heard about it, and then I thought, oh, that's okay. And that's if you look at a fern leaf, there's these little seed pods on the side of them, you know, on the edge of the leaf, and what happens is that the ferns eject sperm, and the sperm swim downstream and up to another fern and climb all the way up to the fern to mate with it. So that does my head in a bit. And so this is why ferns grow in big clumps near waterfalls. They need the water to live, but they also need the water to send sperm around. So, and now I don't know how it disperses from there, but necessarily, if you decide you're a fern, you've been dispersed, and you go to a another puddle of water which is not connected, the sperm can't get to you. You ain't gonna have any baby ferns. So this gets to a point about vision, which is light sensitivity. There are plants which display a certain light sensitivity, and I would dare say, I don't know if you've ever seen this, this is something which sort of struck me. For a while I would walk past some plants in the morning, then I walk past them in the evening and I go, something's a bit odd here. And these are just not too many Australian plants. There's not too many big flowers here, but there's something called a little soursob, which is a plague plant. So there's a lot of plants that people went, oh, this one won't hurt. And the soursob is the little yellow plant from Europe, and it was put in a pot. And we know, or at least we think we know, this particular woman didn't want it anymore and threw it out on a tram, out of a train, apparently. At least that's what I was told, I think, in grade three. And it spread everywhere, along with several other things. But that's one flower, which is fairly common around here. I think daisies are. They actually are light sensitive, and they actually follow the light. And you see them moving up, pointing their little flower thing to the light. So that's pretty amazing stuff. Then you've got the evolution of some light-sensitive cells which get recessed in a pit. And I think Richard Dawkins loved to talk about this. And I think, I don't know, Richard Dawkins is sort of picks the bait of these religious people. And he gets hated, and he sort of likes, he gets off being hated. I guess a bit like Descartes saying, oh, look, just keep a low profile and work away, improving your mind. So Richard Dawkins, yeah. But he does a fairly good thing about the evolution of the eye. So what happens is that the directionality of light cells, they become more sensitive if they get a bit more recessed. They get a bit more recessed. And then perhaps for tidal and other features, they grow a film over it. That film evolves to a lens. And that lens eventually goes to a separate organ which can rotate in its socket. Now, that's one type of eye, evolutionary length of one eye, but it's not like that all the time. And the one that I want to really point about, and this is really important because it's an invention of nature which has given us optical fibres, is the light guide channel array. So this is things which have a grid channel, and the light, if it goes in at the right angle, it bounces down the array to individual photoreceptors. So there's a light channel above every little photoreceptor. And of course, this is your Cray's eye. So I knew when I began my PhD there, I was looking after honours students, and one honours student at Adelaide University was making up a Cray's eye to pick up X-rays from cosmic ray events, or light flashes from cosmic ray events. These are non-imaging things. And so it's basically, if you've got, say, a whole series of toilet rolls put together, you can actually see by looking down them, have each one. And of course your brain can be pretty good, but then insects do process some pretty amazing vision. So you've got spiders with eight eyes, things with a fair number of eyes, like your cricket. You think your cricket's, oh, that's got two eyes, but you look at the top of its head, it's got these two little lumps, and they're just light detectors. So there's one for eyes for imaging, and there's one eyes for what time of the day is. Now that's true for us humans as well. We've got our eyes, but we've also got light detector regions which just plug into where, the amount of light. Is it daytime? Is it morning? Well, it doesn't. There's the main eye stuff for us, which takes down image. But there are other cells in the eye which just secrete hormones. You'll know this for sure. So that's they secrete hormones with the blue light of the day, and that goes in and sets your circadian light. Ergo, some bright spots have made the red evening screen for, which looks rather hideous and actually sends me to sleep, which is, I suppose, the idea of it. You yourself have got your normal eye, but you've also got other sensitive cells which don't go back into your vision, go back into your... I've gotten S in something or other, cortex, super charismatic caustex. I don't know whether that word's correct or not. This just came into my mind. But the cells go into that, and there's a complex thing which looks a bit like you Americans would have the lines going back and forth as they explain your plays in gridiron. For me, that's just the most insane sport. Like, it's half legal, it appears to be half legal, half chess, and then a bit of brutality of thumping each other. But, you know, their plays, well, that's pretty much what it looks like in the head. All these cells emit hormones and sets a chain off, which sets your circadian rhythm. And so there's light-sensitive cells in insects, which are eyes. They're called compound eyes, and we're beginning to know exactly how they process things and what wavelengths they're sensitive to. So they basically get sensitive to lights that are important to their their survival. And so with bees, they can see in the ultraviolet light because there's ultraviolet colouring on the flowers, which sticks up. Now, there's sort of flowers do this, and they sort of evolve things that their success is reliant. So they co-evolve. They co-evolve and actually pick up an insect group or a particular group. So there are some flowers, say, which have a very long funnel, and the proboscis, you need a very long proboscis, which a certain insect does, definitely has. And you say, oh, look, that's pretty crazy, because that insect can only eat on those flowers, which means that you've got a heap of thousands of millions of flowers, but you've got insects which you've evolved to ignore all the other flowers and look after that. Does that sort of make sense? So if you've got a particular fruit, or we'll say like fruit and our colour vision have come together. So fruit goes red, but it also relies on the colour vision. That's for a lot of it, for eating the actual fruit and dispersal. So while we're sort of looking at eyes and the survival and the evolution to your niche, and the niche means you rule your niche, and the niche is something that it's sort of this back and forth feedback system. We should start off and say that the dinosaurs, as far as we know, evolved three, possibly four, sometimes 5 degrees of colour vision. So your flying dinosaurs today, the dinosaurs which live today and enjoy several dinosaur features, including a more efficient lung sac system. So they're not lungs as we understand it, where you breathe in, miss some energy, moves out. These are high efficient lungs, which are like turbocharged lungs. So all birds have a different lung system. So that's a bit hard to understand. And a lot of the bird is actually lung. If you cut it open, that hollow stuff in that chook which you cook up a lot, the inside of that is lung. And that means that they use their oxygen more efficiently, therefore can actually burn their fuel more efficiently, therefore they can fly. So we've got exceptions to that, like the bat, but you don't have bats doing migrations. Well, I'll surely be proven wrong on this, but bats do large migrations. I think bats are one of the most numerous mammals on Earth, if I just remember with data from somewhere. So your birds are your dinosaurs, and they rule the daytime, and as reptiles. Reptiles are cold-blooded. Birds are slightly warm-ish blooded. I don't know how you define it. And the dinosaurs were warmish blooded, and so they were daytime things. Why not be at the daytime? You've got good vision at daytime. And were they solar powered? You know, the basic things. Did a Tyrannosaurus Rex, what can you imagine, what does that animal do except scream and rip down buildings and throw cars around like a Zilla? So but that must have been you can imagine if they were around today, there would be people be loving them and keeping them as pets. You know, this Tyrannosaurus Rex, it only just eats one or two kids, and you know, I love it so much, and it's a chain, it's so loyal, and it's a really I think we can actually say that birds are super bright. I thought the birds that I have up around here in Australia are they're domesticated, and you tend to, if they're domesticated or tame, they're not domesticated, they're tame, so they come up and sit on your feet and stuff like that. You think you put a bit of brightness into them, but look, I'm pretty sure there's some pretty intelligent birds out there, because they say you go for a walk and they follow you around, or you say, oh, gee, that bird, it's sitting out there right in front of me. And you realise, oh, look, that's actually sitting there because it wants to see, you know, have a see with you. And so, but bear in mind, the dinosaurs are pretty big, and they're not fully evolved. As evolved, there are things about things which evolved in their evolution. I think their kidney structure wasn't up to scratch, so they were very inefficient, or some of them were very inefficient. There were things with those dinosaurs with those big sails on the back, so they could soak up the sun's rays. Now, I think those actually weren't dinosaurs, if I can remember reading a beautiful early 1970s dinosaur book, which I used to read to my kid. But I think those were sauropods. I can't remember. They're things, something or other. They're actually not dinosaurs in the dinosaur family. They're giant reptiles, and there were amphibians, a whole heap of, and ichthys, something or other, fish, things that they were not technically dinosaurs. And I just want to think whether a pterodactyl or a pretosaurus. There's a whole heap of them which we class in with dinosaurs, because we look at them there. They're around in Barney and the dinosaur train, all these insane things. Not all of them, not all dinosaurs, not all the creatures in Barney, for instance, I think are technically dinosaurs. Of course, there was never a purple dinosaur with large ring of teeth like it, although the teeth in Barney are along flat teeth with no holes in it, gaps in it, and that's similar to a dinosaur called a something or other donth, a megalodonth, and that's where it's got this, had a tooth pretty much like Barney. It just ground itself down like, and elephants today don't have a separate big tooth. They've got one sort of big back tooth, and their tusks aren't teeth, they're actually hairs. Sort of interesting thing, like ivory is actually hair, it's not the tooth molecule, so it's a more keratin matrix rather than a calcium phosphate crystal, which is your tooth with the internals of it. So we're just going on. The dinosaurs developed vision, and the mammals, well, there is a question whether they had ever colour vision. They were sort of little night little scurrying things. The mammals really were, back then, dinosaur garnishes. You can imagine at a dinosaur dinner party going, oh, it's for dinner. Oh, I found these nice little mammals. Oh, they're not very filling. They're pretty small. Actually too small. So being nighttime and being small was the thing to do. I don't know what they lived off, because there ain't too many insects at night, if you noted that. There's only spiders at night. or around here there is. There's, look, I don't see any insects, neither even the ant. I say it's wrong. There are actual little populations of insects. You may as well talk about them. Around here in Australia, there's these fantastic things called sugar ants. They're big. They look like they look like nasty bull ants, but you pick them up. And they're the softest, most gentle ant. They're not that bright, and they walk along in these big chains and colonies. And we had one at our patio. We've got a sort of an Aussie house with a veranda around the outside, and at night we'd have this huge parade of ants, and I don't know, various ignorant people would try and kill them. Like, oh no! And I had my various ignorant people with fly spray spraying them, and no. And what they do is they go off at night in a big thing and actually go up a few gum trees. There's a special gophra gum tree out the front of our place, which is a chili gum tree, and they climb up that, and they do what a lot of ants do, is they milk and farm the pests of the gum tree, and they come back. And so so those ants definitely move. There are a couple of ants that move at night, but they don't move during the day. Now, the story of that is that they built this huge colony underneath our veranda, and of course it rotted some wood, and I was sure we got termites, but no, we had these ants, so I had to actually move these ants on, this beautiful nest on. But we'll eventually get to talking about eyes, the structure of eyes. But we've got this evolutionary path, and sort of when you're committed to an evolutionary path, a dumb design sort of gets stuck in it for a fair while. So it's like your old PC. If you've got a bad design PC, you can keep on having upgrades to it, but it may have a fundamentally poor architecture. What I'm doing is just checking around here. I don't know whether someone's going to come up and... I don't know, there's someone out the back of their yard checking on me. For the mad person walking around the oval. So as I'm talking, we mammals, we are the squishy, hairy things which have all these placentals. We're the placentals of mammals, and then there's the monotremes, and the marsupials are all hairy, soft, squishy things. In general, we have two dichromatic vision. And of course, we are a bit different because we had a mutation of one of our cones which went AWOL, which is a greenish cone, which meant that we can see, it's a bit like the red cone, but a bit different. I'll have to talk about what the cones are. The cone cells in your eyes, and so we can see, we've sort of mucked along with evolution, and we can see greens, and what's also is that our red cone cell has evolved to have a bit of sensitivity in the ultraviolet, so we can see right into, which perhaps monkeys can't, or things which haven't evolved down this line. We can see into the ultraviolet, or the purple. So this is purple, spectral purple, rather than paint pot purple. So this purple of a laser beam, which is different from you picking up some red and some blue and mixing it together, because that's what your cone cell in the back of your eye has some additional sensitivity way out in the ultraviolet. And so what happens is it kicks in and tells you ultraviolet looks purple, which to us, if you've never studied about anything, look, if you really don't worry about anything, you just do as you're told, just pick things up, and none of this is a worry. I often have a bit of a conversation, someone says, I said, look, you're worried about something. I said, oh, it just doesn't make sense. And they said, oh, I know what you have to do, you just have to accept what you're told. So that's my failing in life, and not necessarily accepting what I'm told. But we're going to talk about the structure of the eye. So we've got three cones. Your dog has got two, your cow's got two, your bull's got two cones. Now there's a few exceptions to this, which is noted the as we think we're pretty good being able to see green and blues, sort of purples again. It's the caribou which takes the cake, and the reason is it's got really excellent ultraviolet vision, because the Arctic wolves, which go yum yum, let's go, where are we going tonight, Mum? Oh, let's eat some caribou. So caribou is your name for Santa's reindeer. The Canadians want to quarantine their population off from reindeer duty, so they call them caribou. So these are sort of Arctic, I don't know, moose, deer. I don't quite understand what technically caribou is. It's got some horns and it used to go on large migrations. I think they still do in Canada. They haven't industrialised enough to reckon up. But these caribou are in the snow. Your Arctic wolf's gone. Oh, press the evolution button. I'll just have, rather than a fluoro coat, I'll have a snow white coat. But you can't beat the laws of physics. In fact, that fur really scatters short wavelength light due to my scattering or whatever it is, but it will look a lot more different than the ultraviolet. And so this is what the caribou which basically caribous without this have lost the evolutionary selection test and have actually been eaten up rather quickly, and therefore they've got vision. We've got the vision of what we have because we like to swing around the trees and eat fruit, various other things. Perhaps we also used it to see when our females were on heat. We needed to see that as well, or I suppose you'd have scent and various things along those lines. We didn't need scent as much, and so we can't smell. Humans don't smell. That is, not that they don't produce smell, they actually don't process smell anywhere near anything like the animal kingdom does. So let's go through. There's nothing to do. I've got you the general view that we arrive at the eye after 500 million years of pretty dramatic evolution. Well, look, it's dramatic if you've compressed it into a podcast. Actually living through it is pretty boring. The Hadean Earth would be absolutely boring one day. The next day, what is it? It's raining sulfuric acid. There's no oxygen today. There's no oxygen today. And you do that for hundreds of millions of years. It really gets, goes through actually billions of years waiting on land. Nothing happens. No life on land. Pretty boring. And the dinosaur stuff, we always cut to the great chase scenes, these big things, but the majority of your prehistoric times would be pretty boring unless you're a super scientist, and then those people are boring as well, so it's pretty hard to go. So let's go and do the eye. Look, I'm just speaking along here because I want to do my cardiac rehab, sorry mates. Okay, so your eye's an eyeball, and it's white on the outside. Why is the human eye white on the outside? Because the answer is because it looks good. Someone with a little black pupil and a little white on the outside, it looks lovely, and you can see what something's looking at. If you've got a dog or a horse or a goat, something like that, it may be actually looking you up and down, so looking at your rude bits, for instance, like that, might be there. You can't tell because the iris is the same colour as the white. And what's the I've forgotten what the word of the white of your eye is. Your white of your eye is a social, your social media. It says, you see the whites of your eye when you're frightened, angry, you squish them down. It's a huge signal thing, and you can actually see where someone's looking at. And as a man, I always tend to wear sunglasses, so I can't be accused of looking at. Oh, look, we won't go down there. So, but you'll know the problem of looking at the wrong spot at the wrong time, or not having eye contact, all sort of all this social stuff. So they're every down the white of the eye, and then you have. I may as well go inside the eye. So that white ball on the inside of that ball is a really black, like it's a black membrane, and it's really super black. It's not sort of like black of Texas black with a bit of gloss in it. It is matte black, and it's like the inside of a camera. It just means that light coming in doesn't bounce around too many times, and so when you slice open an eye, and it's always fun to do it at school, it gets icky stuff, you can do it. Now, bear in mind, the slicing of an eye is not something that many people had done throughout history. The Greeks, for instance, thought that the reality was generated in you and shone out of your eye, sort of like, hey, crazy, you won't give that person, the Greeks, a big score in the local science school test. And then it really comes along to, let's talk about the scientists. We're talking about the iris, the cornea, which is the top lens. And I have to say, my cornea has improved unbelievably so. With after my heart operation, my cornea scratchiness has improved, and my actual quality of my vision from the cornea state has improved. That's a scientific fact, because I can actually, I'll do it now. I used to be able to measure the quality of my cornea by looking at a distant streetlight and seeing the number of those lines which come down. So if those lines are very thin and hairy, so they're perfect. It's like a young person's cornea now. So that's the surface of your lens. And I've really forgotten a little bit about what. Oh yeah, we're going to do René Descartes. So he's a French quiet man. I think there's many aspects of him and myself. I think that we've got sort of similarities, but I don't sort of go round up to the pub and saying, hey. I don't hang it on myself and say, hey, I'm as good as a René Descartes. They'd say, who, what? They really wouldn't care. But the similarities in that we both had sort of long military service. I wasn't in the army proper or anything like that. But long times where you're left in your own devices doing military stuff. And both wanted to keep a low profile when it comes to persecution, both sort of come up with the theory of mind, or not theory of, yeah, theory of mind, or theory of reason, believing reason was the way to go ahead. Now, the story where Descartes is that he got a bull's eye, eye from a bull. I think it would be a deceased bull, not a happy bull. He cut it open and used the lens to form an image. There, and we should talk about what a lens is. So a lens was something that they used to, in the Middle Ages, would make these little glass beads which looked like glass lintels. And someone picked up one of these glass lintels and said, it forms an image. So the actual word lens comes from lintel. I like the origin of some words. The origin of the word syllabus, for instance, you're writing a paper on syllabus or the structure of syllabus. You go back, syllabuses weren't at this point in history. Oh, they suddenly burst into existence from the Middle Ages, mid-Middle Ages. And then you find out the word syllabus is a spelling mistake of a monk who's copying down the word table of contents. And when he wrote, where's my whiteout? Oh, it hasn't been invented for the next 300, 400 years. What am I going to do? Oh, just go along, and then someone goes along. They pay a huge amount of money for this manuscript, in terms of food and torturing people and all that type of stuff. And they go, and then someone comes around to dinner, read it here, and I said, oh, syllabus, what's this word? And someone who's, you know, knows it all says, oh, that's a Greek word, syllabus. And they invent this entire origin of the word of it. And what does it mean? Oh, it's sort of like table of contents, but different. It's a bit more intense. And so that's the origin of the word syllabus. So the origin of the word lens is lentil. Now, your lentil or lens is, well, it's a living thing. It's got an oxygen supply from oxygen pumping oxygen into your liquid of your eye. And there's blood supply, as you would know, there's blood supply right up to it. That is, if you have a few tequilas too many, I must admit, I have never, ever drunk a tequila. I know that they have a little worm inside the tequila, but no one has ever given me a tequila. So there you go. But you get a bloodshot eye, so you can have, there's blood shots in the eyes, and you know this, that some drug addicts sort of go, oh, I've used up all my veins, the only vein I can find is in my eye, and actually inject the drug into the eye, believe it or not. And so the blood supply's there, and your lens is this fantastic thing. So there's two groups of muscles. There's a group of muscles around your iris, which shutters out the amount of light, and there's a lens which has got, so cornea does a fair amount of the refractive, the bending of the light, and the lens does a bit of a tweaking with it. And as you get older, the lens doesn't work as well. And it's, and again, after this heart surgery, I don't need to, I haven't had to stop having to use set of glasses. How good is that? And I think that defies logic, but I don't care. It's great. After this, sort of everything coming back. But as you age, your lens can't operate as much. In fact, what you can do is you can check your minimum focal length under certain things and just read it off a ruler and get your age to within a couple of months. So your lens slowly jams up. And you also, your lens hues and blues. And so you eventually don't see the blue. The lens starts to absorb it. Underneath your lens is something called the vitreous humour, which is that jelly-like stuff, but it's not as simple as you think. So the vitreous humour is got a liquid, but it's also got channels through it and guy ropes across. You say, guy ropes? How the heck does that happen? And it is true, it's got little strands and ropes across it and tubes across it. So liquid can get passed through the eye. It can clean out its vitreous humour. There's a lot going on there. And if you think that's garbage, I don't have it in many eye diagrams, but there is this little tendon going from the back of your eye to the lens. Believe it or not, it's see-through, the liquid goes through, it's all pretty much the same refractive index and all that type of stuff. Forms this sort of nutritious jelly. And vitreous humour means a glass-like humour, means a liquid vitreous humour. And indeed, you can get parasites living in all parts of your eye, but there's examples of these parasites which bore into your eye, and you can actually see it swim as a shadow swim across. In fact, if you have, what happens is with your eye, if you have a bump or something like that, or young, and you see a blank background, look into a blank light source, like a perfectly white sheet of paper, or a distant white painted wall, or a distant skyline, you can see these things which are diffraction effects on the back of your eye called floaters. That is, the light just streams into your eye, your lens is not doing anything in particular, and these floaters form an image on your eye, and you can see them as little floating bubbles in your vision. If you haven't seen it, well, you haven't been observant, but they can be quite distracting. If you're looking down at a microscope, you can see, you can work out, oh, is this optics dirty? And of course, if you rotate your eye and they're the thing where it stays in the same position, and it's actually inside your eye. So again, I used to notice that when I was 7 years old, something like that. Probably again a few years ago. Now I don't see them anymore. And what happens is that your brain puts in software upgrade to eliminate that. In fact, the brain does a hell of a lot of things. So we've got the light coming into your eye, through your cornea, being shuttered out, passing through the iris, passing through the lens, going into the vitreous humor, and is it going to hit the retina? No. Okay, not quite. Well, some of the time it does. But what it does is that we mammals have backed an evolutionary path along with our dud lungs. We've also got dud eyes, and we've got dud eyes. I'll talk about it for a short while. The dud eyes are there in terms of that the nerves, all the wiring that you'd expect on the back of the retina are in the front. So the veins and the and everything are sticking out the front of your eye. So if you look at an image of your retina, it's this insane thing, like looking into the human body, but you're not seeing just a thing like you look into a camera where it's just a grey area of, hey, I've been designed by someone who's super smart. I've been designed by someone who should have failed design, because they've put the wiring, the power supply for the retina on top of the retina. So the retina has got this a huge point, it's got a huge number of problems with it. So if your eye was a camera and the back of your retina, which is your photoreceptive thing, was a film, and you took a photograph of it and then you developed it, you'd see, oh my god, there's this, all this, what's this, all these heavy lines across it. You take a holiday pic. You can't really take a selfie, I suppose, but you take a picture of your hand or your foot, because you can't really do a selfie with your own head. You'd have to, that's going to be a bit hard. You could probably do a selfie of half your head or something like that. You do a selfie and a picture of it, and this is like this mad kindergarten kid, no, put it a year 8 student has got across it and dawdled all across your photograph, and that's putting veins and arteries all the way up to feed your eye, and a bit of there's a black spot there which everything roots out, your power plug in the middle, and you go, oh my god, what's happening here? But obviously not a problem. Now there's two routes to this not a problem thing. One is, it's not a problem because I say so, I'm a teacher, I'm teaching this lesson, and shut up. No, look, you're mistaken. Or you can actually go and say what happens scientifically. And of course, there's a lot of processing power in the back of the retina, so that your retina's actually got a bit of CPU on the back of it. And your eye vibrates really quickly and blurs out blurs out the actual shadow, and you can't see it. It's sort of like super smart. Your eyes are probably sometimes probably the smartest part of your body is your eyes, and so this goes out. So your retina's on the top now. Vessels on the top. So of course, what they can do is when you've got heart disease or anything like that. Let's have a little look at your actual tiny little arteries. How does they really look? Wouldn't it be nice if I could actually just whittle away all your flesh and just see your little arteries and veins there? And so they can have a look, and they can give you a tick of cardiac vascular health health there. Now, of course, again, what was happening with me is I was having, from the cardiac thing, a little strokes breaking off, and what would happen is the little clots would stop in the eye, and I'd have a 30-second blackout here, or bits of my vision would black out. I didn't know what was happening at the time, but so if you now know it, and I was able to actually track the size of the clots and the frequency by noting what was going on. Now, that's getting towards all I want to say about the eye. Then you've got muscles on the outside moving on. And I think when you go into if you go into REM sleep, they flip forward and oscillate together. But deep sleep, your eye actually rolls backwards. Now, why would your eye roll backwards? So when you into deep sleep and you lift it up, and someone's not in REM sleep, the eyes actually roll backwards. And there's also the tears and the muscles and the optic nerve. So all the nerves, so all the axons at the back of the eye trunk together and form your optic nerve. And your optic nerve goes all the way back, plus does a little bit of, I don't know how it does it, it feeds a little bit of information to your amygdala. So there's some image processing process there. Don't ask me how it happens. That goes back to your head. And what happens is that the vision that you have is upside down. If you have a lot of lens, it's upside down. So what it does is it crosses over. I don't know how this happens. It crosses the your thing that you see on the left side goes to the right back brain, inverted, and the other stuff on the other side goes to your left-hand brain, and it twists over. And so what you see and perceive doesn't actually twist over. You learn what's up and what's down, and you learn to process the information into 3D. You get stereo vision. So there are people I've met, this, I think it was Mrs. Legge, a teacher, who was at Xavier Jesuit School, and she just had one of those things that she couldn't perceive three dimensions. Her brain just didn't process it. And you can get that sort of thing after strokes and stuff like that, not perceiving three-dimensional information. But she's still driving, but you'd think you'd really want a good old handle on those old three dimensions coming forward. Now, the reason is why is the imaging, or firstly, the imaging process is at the back of the brain. And so what happens is that, say if you get in a bar fight, say you're, I'm going to say, a sailor from another nation visiting Sydney, and you say the wrong thing, you get in a bar fight and they punch you in the face, what will happen is that your I don't know quite how it happens. Your brain is of lower density than your fluid. So the fluid rushes to the back of the brain. Oh, I've got to really think about how this works. But you see stars and an optical illusion. It's not, the optical illusion is your brain actually having a shock, and you've got the optical lobes at the back of your head. And so if you go up the back and put your hand behind your head, sitting back, you're probably listening to this in a big bubble bath. Imagine that you're in a big bubble bath and someone's brought you in a lovely martini or whatever it is, and there's bubbles everywhere, and you're leaning back and you put your arms, your hands back behind your head, your hands folded at the back of your head. That's your region of your optical region. And you'd say, well, why is that? Because if I was designing my brain, I would desire, I'd have the circuitry at the power supplies and everything at the back of the retina, where it's good. And so there's something else I've got to mention. And then I'd have the processing power just behind the eye, because that's a long path of travel. And in actual fact, our eye response is slower than ear response. So ear goes straight into your head. Eye response is a little bit slower. And there's two things I'll talk about. One is various optical illusions. But the reason that your signal processing is at the back is that it used to be at the front, but evolution has said upgrade time, and we'll just cut your brain open and put something in front. And at the very front is your frontal lobe, which is the most thought processing stuff. And of course, your vision, which has evolved from 300 million years ago, is sat at the back. So you've actually got, you pack a fair number of different sorts of brains. Now the signals goes to the amygdala, Maglia, can't pronounce it properly, and that actually picks up snakes. It's actually a precision part of the brain, the fear part of the brain, and you can actually see a snake or something that's going to kill you really, really quickly, faster than you could process normally. And so they've done studies for it in terms of you can have subliminal images, which you don't see, but if there's a snake, subliminal image, they measure the conductivity of your skin or something like that. I really don't know whether this is popular science or true. You can actually actually see it through. So there's just one or two extra things. The back of your eyes have a reflective layer on, and so the light hits it to your retina, doesn't meet it there, it bounces back off your retina for a second chance, and that is red eye. So you do a flash photograph because the way that the lens, if the person is looking directly at the camera, it's actually set up that the camera is like a laser beam going to the eye. It's just exactly as it will go down to a point. It bounces off the point, and the opposite is that flash will be shot straight back at the camera. And this is some little bit of optics. If it's not because it's a flat mirror, no, it's a curved mirror with a lens in front of it. And that's you get a few examples of that in cat's eyes on the road. They've got a corner cube reflector. There's another geometry which works, which is a lens and a mirror at the focal plane. That means that light entering the lens will emerge back out from the lens at the same angle. That is, that you get red eye from a number of angles going into the eye, so you don't have to be, you don't have to have your eye perfectly oriented. It's anywhere with the flash, and of course, you know, sort of come back. Cameras now extract the red eye, or I think that what they do is they do a pre-flash to get your irises to suddenly shrink down and go across. And now the reflector, the iris circuitry, the iris detection light, and sending the muscles through shows it's a basic reflex. So, is he dead, Doc? Go up and you just look at the eye. And you know those movies where they get a flashlight and hit it? So you can be brain dead, you know, comatose, but if there's still life in there, still blood flowing around, you'll see it. And so one of the symbols of death is that you don't get that iris contracting and going along with it. So there's eye vibrations and stuff like that to get whole heaps of software upgrades to do it. And that's your eye, and it's a complex thing, but it's one of those things that is worth coming back to a few times over and over. You can keep on talking about it and getting more and more knowledge. It's sort of like you've got two paths. You can have the shut up, I did that at school, I don't want to hear any more about it, I can draw an eye, and let's do it. Or you can say, look, that's interesting, and keep on just piling in the facts, because it is a fairly complex thing, but there's nothing too complex about any one part. It just requires a bit of patience to work through, and I think that reflects a lot of science, that people are wanting sort of news grabs, quick lessons. They want a reason to know something, and I don't know if there's actually a reason to know all this about the eye. It's just what you know about, and I think it also reflects society that there's certain things that we know a hell of a lot about, say like the Aussie cricket team or World Cup soccer. We might know about the rules of soccer. It's something, or latest music bands. It's what we know about it for its social value, its social currency. So I think knowing about the eye has got low social currency, but it's a diagnostic tool for our own health and understanding and well-being. It's well worth learning about it. Thanks for listening. podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.